Hello and welcome to Resources Radio, a weekly podcast from Resources for the Future. I'm your host, Daniel Ramey. Today, we talk with Simon Greenhill, a PhD student in agricultural and resource economics at UC Berkeley, and Hannah Druckenmiller, assistant professor of economics at the California Institute of Technology and an RFF University Fellow. Along with several co-authors, Simon and Hannah recently published an innovative study that uses machine learning tools to try and determine which locations are subject to regulation under the Clean Water Act. As we'll discuss, there are multiple ways to interpret what locations should or shouldn't be subject to regulation, but even once you decide on how to define a water of the United States, the locations that should be regulated, it can be really complicated to figure out exactly which specific locations are subject to the law. Simon, Hannah, and their co-authors have developed a really cool tool to help make this process easier and to better understand the environmental and economic consequences of Clean Water Act regulations. We'll talk about all of it on today's episode. Stay with us. All right, Simon Greenhill, welcome to Resources Radio. Hannah Druckenmiller, welcome back to Resources Radio. It's great to have both of you with us.
Thanks. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, thanks, Daniel.
So as I mentioned, Hannah has been on the show before, but Simon, it's your first time. So welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. I'd love to ask you the same question we ask all of our guests at the beginning of the show, which is, just what kind of inspired you to work on environmental issues?
Yeah, thanks. It's great to be here. So I grew up in kind of a rural-ish part of California and was just really fortunate to have great outdoor access there. And so as a kid, I spent a lot of time outdoors. And then as I kind of got older, that developed into a love for, you know, hiking and then later rock climbing, backpacking, trail running, stuff like that. And then as I was going through my education, I was really interested in human behavior and sort of what determines human behavior. And that started out as an interest in journalism. And then I kind of discovered economics and particularly kind of fell in love with the approach of using data to try to learn things about the world and particularly to learn things about society. And then I kind of found environmental economics as this marriage of, you know, the environment, something that I had been really passionate about throughout my life. And then the sort of economic and social systems that I've always been interested in. So that kind of felt like a natural fit and yeah, excited to be doing that now.
Yeah, that's really cool. Where in California did you grow up?
I grew up on the peninsula. So like Palo Alto kind of area, but more kind of in the hills. So as you sort of go west toward the coast, so it's fun because it's like you're 30 minutes from, you know, San Francisco, you're close to like Stanford's campus and stuff like that, but you're also kind of feel like you're up in the mountains.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful part of the world. I totally understand how inspiring it is. Well, let's get into the substance of our conversation today, which is around a paper that the two of you recently published along with a team of co-authors. The paper's called Machine Learning Predicts Which Rivers, Streams, and Wetlands the Clean Water Act Regulates. It's in the journal Science. We'll have a link to it in the show notes at the bottom of the page. But one of the first things that's important to do in any conversation about the Clean Water Act is defining a couple terms. And the first term that we should define is waters of the United States. So can you define for us what are waters of the United States and why are they important?
Sure. So I can do my best, but you'll see why this is difficult in just a moment. So Waters of the United States, or WOTUS for short, describes a set of water resources that's regulated under the Clean Water Act. But one of the reasons that the Clean Water Act is so controversial, and you're constantly seeing it in the news and the Supreme Court, is that WOTUS is actually not clearly defined in the original legislation. And so it's actually up to the EPA and the Army Corps to interpret what WOTUS means. And this is repeatedly reinterpreted each time we see a new presidential administration or each time the Supreme Court revisits what WOTUS was considered under the original writing. So let me give a few examples of different water resources to help try and make this concrete. So I think everyone agrees that major rivers, something that the EPA and the Army Corps call traditional navigable waterways, you can think of the Mississippi, for example, everyone agrees that these water resources are regulated. There's also some things we all agree are not regulated. You can imagine a puddle in your backyard on a rainy day. No one is saying that that's regulated by the Clean Water Act or that that's WOTUS. But there's a whole category of resources in between these two things where it's not actually clear whether they're WOTUS or not. So to give a few examples, you can think of an ephemeral stream, which is a stream that only flows on rainy days, or an isolated wetland, which is a wetland that's not directly connected to a stream or a river. These are things that we're repeatedly debating whether they fall under the definition of WOTUS or not.
That is great. And just one more clarification question before we talk a little bit about policy history, Hannah. You know, what does it actually mean to be regulated? So if, like, I am a farmer and there is an intermittent stream on my land, what does it mean for that stream to be regulated for me as a farmer?
Sure. So something being regulated mostly means that you have to get a permit in order to develop on it. So I'm going to switch your example from a farmer to a developer, because farmers actually have exceptions under the Clean Water Act that makes that example a little murky. But imagine you're a developer and you want to buy a property and build a, you know, a residential development there. If this land is not regulated, you can go ahead and build whatever you want at kind of the market cost. If it is regulated under the Clean Water Act, you have to undergo approval process in order to build there, which often requires costly mitigation measures for whatever you build. So to give an example of a wetland, if I wanted to build a residential development on a wetland, I might have to then invest in wetland mitigation banks, which is kind of this system that's meant to restore the ecosystem services that you demolish when you pave over a wetland somewhere else in the watershed. So you can see why this might make it prohibitively costly to develop in places that are regulated.
That is a perfect example, and also helps us understand why this is such a controversial and kind of economically significant topic. So next question, I'm wondering if you can give us some policy background on how the Supreme Court and different administrations have interpreted WOTUS in recent years. You mentioned that these definitions kind of swing back and forth with different administrations, and then help us understand some of the environmental and economic implications of those different interpretations.
Sure. So I'd say, loosely speaking, we see two kind of big interpretations of WOTUS. One, which I'll call a broader interpretation, includes more of those ambiguous cases, like ephemeral streams and isolated wetlands, in the class of resources that is regulated in the definition of WOTUS. And then there's a narrower interpretation, which tends to exclude many of these water resources. So in our paper, we look at two of these different rules. There have been several over the last few decades, but we focus on two in particular. One we call Rapinos, which is based on a 2006 Supreme Court case, where the Supreme Court established a significant nexus criteria for WOTUS. And that's a kind of a big fancy term, but what it meant was that any water resource that shared a physical, chemical, or biological connection to a traditional navigable waterway could be considered as part of WOTUS. And so this allowed for the inclusion of ephemeral streams and isolated wetlands under that definition. The second rule that we look at is a narrower interpretation of WOTUS. This was the Navigable Waters Protection Rule, or NUPR for short, which is a Trump-era rule. And this rule basically required that a water resource needed to share a continuous surface water connection with a traditional navigable waterway in order to be regulated. And so that actually excluded some of these resources, like ephemeral streams and isolated wetlands, from the definition of WOTUS. So you can see, you know, it gets quite technical, but you can think of this as being kind of a broader interpretation of what can be regulated under Rapinos and a narrower interpretation under NUPR.
Perfect. All right, so we're in a great starting point. Let's talk a little bit now about the sort of difficulty, the technical difficulty, once you get past these legal questions about how to actually map the scope of water resources in the United States. In your paper, you cite EPA and the Army Corps as stating in all caps, no less. I don't know if the all caps is significant or not. You can tell me if they are. But in all caps, it says, existing tools cannot accurately map the scope of Clean Water Act jurisdiction. So why is that? Why is it so hard to map these waters?
Yeah. So I think first, I think that all caps is significant. And in fact, it was even bold, I think, in the initial document. So, you know, a strong statement from the EPA and the Army Corps that, you know, I guess until now, there haven't been tools that allow us to map Clean Water Act jurisdiction. And the reason this is difficult is that the main way that Clean Water Act jurisdiction is determined is through a process called the Approved Jurisdictional Determination Process, or AJD process. And that's a fundamentally case-by-case process. The way it works is, you know, picking up Hannah's example from earlier, if I'm a developer and I think there might be a Water of the United States on the property that I'm planning to develop, I go to the Army Corps and I say, hey, could you please come and review sort of this location and let me know, are there waters of the United States here or not? And, you know, then someone from the Army Corps will either sort of look at data from their desk and in some cases make a field visit and decide, you know, under the currently operative rule, whether that's Rapanos or Nuper or something else, you know, this location or there is a water of the United States here or there is not. And anytime the rule changes, it's not like the Army Corps does or even could ask its staff to make thousands or millions of sort of fake determinations in order to be able to, or I shouldn't say fake determinations, but sort of pseudo determinations in order to be able to then create a map and say, here's what's regulated and what's not. Instead, it's more like as the rule is actually sort of enforced and is put into law, we learn as we go what is regulated. And so what we do in our paper is sort of create almost an automated way based on the past decisions that the Army Corps have made of determining jurisdiction by actually using the decisions that they made through that AJD process.
That's great. And I'd love for you to sort of take us a cut deeper on that, and particularly, you know, what are some of the methods you use to try to map what is WOTUS and what is not WOTUS under these different broader or more narrow interpretations?
Yeah, so a sort of big picture way of trying to think about what we're doing is we try to use machine learning to basically recreate the decision problem that the Army Corps faces. So in particular, we take a bunch of data as inputs. These are things like aerial imagery of the location that's being evaluated, maps of the wetlands and streams, the soil types, the local climate, things like that. And we feed those into a machine learning model. We specifically use a convolutional neural network, which we don't need to get into the details of right now, but is a type of model that's particularly good at sort of seeing patterns in spatial data. And so in that sense is sort of well suited to this task. And then out of that model, we get a decision, which is sort of equivalent to the decision that, you know, someone at the Army Corps might make, basically a prediction, either regulated or not regulated. And so the sense in which this is recreating the decision problem that someone at the Army Corps would face is that we use the same inputs that they use. We know that because they actually, in their decisions, they often write, you know, I looked at imagery from this location and then I consulted the National Hydrography data set and came to this decision. And so we sort of selected our inputs based on that. And then we're, as an output, predicting these actual legally binding regulatory decisions. And so I think that makes our approach really powerful because we're predicting, you know, actual decisions that the Army Corps made as opposed to some proxy for what might be regulated. And again, using that same data. And then sort of once we have that, we can predict at as many places as we want at very low cost. And that's what allows us to create these sort of more comprehensive maps of what is and isn't regulated under different rules.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And I'm wondering if you can say a word or two about the application of the information that you're developing with these tools. Are you sort of envisioning that the Army Corps would use the model that you've built to help them make decisions? Or is it intended for broader public consumption? Like who's the audience, or who are the audiences that you think could be most benefited by using this tool?
Yeah, I think there's many potential applications of this tool. I think that basically this gives us visibility into what is regulated under different rules that have existed in the past, and of course that can resemble rules that might exist presently or in the future. And so that can be useful to somebody who's trying to understand whether they might be regulated, right? The location that they want to develop might be regulated. It could also help, as you mentioned, someone at the Army Corps make a decision and sort of potentially help to provide decision support in that sense to the people who are actually implementing the law. And I think it also allows us to kind of think about the implications more broadly, right? Get these aggregate statistics of how many stream miles are regulated or unregulated under different rules in the past, or how many wetland acres are regulated or unregulated. And so those allow us to get these kind of big picture summary statistics that I think can be helpful simply for understanding what the Clean Water Act is actually doing.
Yeah. Well, let's go to that now. I'm wondering if, you know, one of you or both of you can share some of those summary statistics. And, you know, what does the model tell us about how different interpretations of WOTUS, right, the sort of broader Rapinos or the more narrow NUPER interpretations, how do they affect the regulations of streams and wetlands and other parts of the United States?
Sure. So I'll just pick up where Simon left off, and we can talk first about streams and rivers and wetlands. So we find that Rapinos, which is, again, that broader interpretation of WOTUS, regulates about two-thirds of streams and rivers in the U.S. And then when we move to NUPER, under the Trump-era rule, we see that less than half of streams and rivers are regulated. This isn't equal across all types of streams and rivers. Consistent with kind of the language of the rule change, we find that intermittent streams are more likely to be deregulated than perennial streams, for example. So let's just provide you with a sense of scale of those numbers. NUPER deregulates about 680,000 stream miles. That's the length of every river and stream in California, Florida, Illinois, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Texas combined. So this is just a massive amount of water resources. When we look at wetlands, we find a similar pattern. So about half of wetlands are regulated under Rapinos, that broader interpretation, and that shrinks to about a quarter of all wetlands under NUPER. So we see that a quarter of all wetlands in the United States are deregulated with this rule change, or half of previously regulated wetlands. Again, consistent with kind of the language of the rule change, we find that deregulation is more dramatic among isolated wetlands than wetlands that are directly connected to a stream or a river. So in total, we find that the rule change deregulates about 35 million wetland acres. How big is 35 million acres? That's about the size of the state of Wisconsin or the state of Florida. So again, this is a huge amount of area that's losing regulation under this rule change. So I guess in addition to those high-level statistics, we could also tell you about some case studies that we look at in the paper that reveal kind of interesting patterns. So first, we find that both rules regulate all major rivers, which is consistent with how we think that the Clean Water Act operates in practice. But we do see that under the narrower interpretation of WOTUS, under NUPER, there's a narrowing of water resources that are regulated in the areas surrounding major rivers like the Mississippi. Another place we take a close look at is the Mountain West. In the Mountain West, a large volume of water actually flows through ephemeral streams, those streams that only flow after rainy days. And we find, again, a large deregulation of these resources when we move from Rapinos to NUPER. And then kind of a last interesting case study, I think, is in the upper Midwest, in a region that's characterized by prairie potholes, which are these freshwater marshes that tend to lack a connection to a surface water, like a stream or a river. And again, we see kind of massive deregulation of these isolated wetlands in that area. So again, this gives us a picture that's kind of consistent with how we expected this rule change to affect different types of water resources. But for the first time, we're actually able to quantify the scale of these changes and think about just how many streams and rivers are affected so that we can start thinking about possible consequences for people and the environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the images that are in the paper are really cool. They give you a great sense of that kind of macro and micro picture that you just sketched out, Hannah, figures 3 and 4 in particular of the paper. So people, I hope, are following along as they listen. Not in your car, of course, but sitting at your desk listening and checking out these pictures. I'd love to ask you to talk more about what you just said, Hannah. You know, what are some of the consequences of these different levels of regulation? Obviously, we're talking about huge amounts of land, you know, huge amounts of water, both at the surface and potentially underground. So, yeah, what are some of the consequences for people and the environment?
Yeah, so this is something that we don't fully explore in the paper, but that many members of our team are really interested in and already working on in follow-up papers. But we do provide a few kind of back-of-the-envelope calculations to put these numbers in context. So to just give you an example, we find that there's this massive deregulation of streams and rivers. It turns out that about 30% of streams and wetlands that are in sub-watersheds that provide drinking water are deregulated. So this might have kind of real consequences for the quality of water that is coming to our taps. We also look at kind of the value of wetlands that are deregulated. So again, we found that about 25% of all wetlands in the United States were deregulated under NUPR. We calculate that that's somewhere in the range of $300 billion of land value in terms of the market value of that land. Or another way we could look at this is the environmental services that that land provides. So we look in particular at the flood mitigation services that wetlands provide, because again, that's something that members of our team have looked at in prior work. And we estimate that 35 million acres of deregulated wetlands provides somewhere in the range of $12 to $20 billion annually in flood mitigation services.
That's really interesting. And I'm wondering, Hannah, is that drawing on your previous work estimating some of the benefits to society of wetlands?
Yeah, so that number is built on an estimate that came out of a paper I have with Charles Taylor that looked at what happens when you lose a wetland to flood damages downstream. And so we kind of combined those spatially resolved estimates of wetland value for flood mitigation with our spatially resolved predictions of where wetlands lost regulation to come up with that number.
Yeah, very cool. So one question that you explore in the paper as a sort of, you know, validation of the technique is looking at how accurately the model is able to match real-world determinations that the Army Corps has made over the years. So can you talk a little bit about the accuracy of the model and how well it lines up with what the Army Corps might have decided in a given case?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is, of course, crucial, right? We have this fancy machinery and these terabytes and terabytes of input data, but it's sort of all for naught if we don't have a model that we actually believe, right? The first thing that I'll mention is that anytime we're talking about accuracy metrics, we're talking about the accuracy on a sort of held out test set. And this is, you know, the general sort of best practice anytime you're dealing with a prediction problem, but is always worth putting front and center, especially for audiences that maybe don't deal with this kind of thing so often. Anytime you're trying to predict something, you sort of break up your data into some data that you're going to use to actually fine tune and train your model, and then some data that is going to be out of sample and that's going to give you a sort of approximation of, you know, how accurate your model is likely to be when you predict on some place where you don't know what the true sort of regulatory status of that place is, or whatever the sort of true value you're trying to predict is. So on that sort of held out of sample test set, our accuracy is about 80% overall, which, you know, we think is pretty good. It's a lot better than, you know, any kind of random guessing that you would get. It's also sort of, we do a number of things to try to unpack, as you mentioned, the accuracy and understand where the model may be more or less accurate. So one of the sort of tests that we do that Hannah already mentioned is we feed in a bunch of points along navigable waterways into the model, and we find that 100% of those are predicted as regulated. This is comforting to us, I think, because navigable waterways actually don't appear in the AJDs, in the approved jurisdictional determinations that the Army Corps is making very much, right? People don't often try to build something in like the middle of Lake Michigan or, you know, the middle of the Mississippi River or something like that. But as we've discussed, like those locations are most definitely regulated, and we definitely want a model that claims to predict regulation to sort of get it right in those obvious cases. So that's great. The other thing that we find, and that's pretty useful about the model, is we find it's well calibrated. What that means is that the model produces a score, which is a number between 0 and 1. And when a model is well calibrated, that means that the score it produces actually maps well to a probability. So if the model gives me a score of 0.05, that means that there's approximately a 5% chance that that point is regulated, you know, under the rule that I'm trying to evaluate. And so what that means is there's sort of subsets of the data where the model is particularly accurate. And that is, those are sort of the cases where the model might be particularly useful, especially when we're talking about decision support or things like that. So looking at that, about 30% of all the AJDs that we sort of held out of sample, about 30% of those can be predicted with a 95% or higher accuracy. About half of them can be predicted with a 90% or higher accuracy. So there's sort of these pockets of the data where the model is particularly high accuracy, and because of this sort of calibration aspect, we can actually determine where those pockets are and maybe get more out of those predictions and have more confidence in some of those predictions than we might in a prediction where the model's kind of saying, hey, you know, this is a toss-up. And maybe speaking of toss-ups, I'll just add one more thing, which is that one of our sort of case studies is the location of the Sackett property, which was the subject of last year's Supreme Court case, and of course is sort of an area of sort of great policy interest and attention. And our model does tend to predict, you know, around 50% chance of regulation under pretty much all the rules if you're looking at exactly that location. So, you know, our model's predictions are consistent with the sort of chain of events that ended, you know, the Sacketts in the Supreme Court.
That's really interesting. One last question to you all before we go to our top of the stack segment, which is building off something you just mentioned, Simon, which is that, you know, the model tends to be maybe more or less accurate under certain conditions or in certain locations. I'm wondering if you can give an example or help us understand, you know, what are the factors, geographical, topographical, I don't know, maybe something having to do with the satellite imagery, that might make the model more or less able to give an accurate prediction in any given location?
Yeah, you know, there's many, and we look into many of them, but I think a really crisp example is the example of a field visit. So the one thing, you know, I've sort of talked on and on about how we're replicating the Army Corps' decision problem and so on and so forth. You know, one thing that our model most definitely cannot do is get up and go on a field visit of a location, right? And you know, this is something that the Army Corps does pretty frequently. Something like 45% of its decisions include a field visit. And, you know, on that field visit, they might find something that, you know, they might sort of, the case might be sort of marginal. You know, they're not really sure based on the imagery and the other data sets they look at. They go to the field and they discover something that's not well reflected in the data, whether it's something that's going on under a, you know, in a forest under a bunch of trees, or maybe there's some sort of groundwater or other subterranean water flow going on. And so we do find our model performs less well in the cases where there was a field visit. And I think that that's intuitive and sort of speaks to, I think we've developed something really powerful and potentially useful here, but there is no world in which, you know, our machine learning model replaces the job that the Army Corps is doing here entirely.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So not a job killing computer program.
I think we strongly think it could be a sort of job augmenting, maybe, right? Like help people be more productive and focus on the most controversial or the most interesting or most sort of edge case cases. But no, certainly not a replacement for anybody's job.
Yeah, cool. Well, This has been a fascinating discussion, Simon and Hannah. I mean, these topics are so complex and rich and thorny in many ways, and you've explained them so clearly. So just really appreciate that. And would love to ask you now to recommend something that you think is great. It could be related to the environment or not. We're not particularly picky on that front. But yeah, just anything that's at the top of your literal or metaphorical reading stack that you think our listeners would enjoy.
Sure. So I have one that's not a new book, but it is one that I recently reread after about a decade, and I loved just as much the second time, which is called The Hungry Tide. It's a fiction novel by Ghosh, and it is about a marine biologist who goes to this kind of rural part of India, the Sundarbans, to find a rare species of dolphin. And on her adventure, she meets up with two locals, a translator and a fisherman. And they go together through this very dangerous forest with crocodiles and tigers and tides that kind of rise on a whim and with devastating consequence. And it's just this really beautiful novel about people trying to live in an unstable environment, and there's political tensions and interpersonal drama, and it's a lovely story about kind of sustainability and also collapse.
Yeah, that's so interesting. You know, we actually just hosted Ben Cahill from CSIS to talk about liquefied natural gas on a recent podcast, and he recommended a different Amitav Ghosh book. So it's in the air.
His books are wonderful. I've read most of them.
Fantastic. How about you, Simon? What's on the top of your stack?
Yeah, mine is a book that I read sort of over the Christmas, New Year holidays that were just a couple months ago. It's The High Sierra, A Love Story by Kim Stanley Robinson. And Kim Stanley Robinson is, of course, this celebrated science fiction author. I guess he's probably best known to the Resources Radio audience for being the author of The Ministry for the Future. This book is nonfiction, and I think it's his only nonfiction book so far. And it's kind of this combination of an autobiographical account of like his own life and how it's reflected through different trips to the mountains that he's taken, you know, over the course of like 40 years. That really resonated with me, even though I'm much younger than Kim Stanley Robinson. I've definitely felt that, you know, outdoor trips have punctuated my life. But then it's also mixed in with this amazing sort of natural and human history of the mountain range, everything from geology to the sort of prehistory or sort of early human history in the range, and then to the sort of arrival of Europeans, people like John Muir, and their efforts to conserve the range sort of in the modern era. And then the final part of the book, which I really love, is it's almost like a guidebook. So it has recommendations for trips and like very opinionated ideas of what kind of gear you should and shouldn't be taking into the mountains. There's like beautiful pictures throughout. So yeah, for me, it was definitely like a really rejuvenating read over the holidays, reconnected me with the mountain range that I really love, and I think inspired some trips that I'm hoping to take this summer. So it was kind of a beautiful package of a book. I don't think I've ever read anything quite like it.
Excellent. That is a fascinating recommendation. And it's actually the same recommendation that we recently got from Lisa Reynolds, who also lives in your neck of the woods in California, and recommended that book as well. So definitely something to check out.
And proof that I'm very cool, because Lisa is extremely cool.
Lisa is extremely cool. I agree. You guys are also extremely cool. Your paper is extremely cool. Simon Greenhill, Hannah Druckenmiller, thank you so much for joining us today on Resources Radio.
Thanks so much for having us. It was really fun.
Yeah, thanks, Daniel. This is great.
You've been listening to Resources Radio, a podcast from Resources for the Future, or RFF. If you have a minute, we'd really appreciate you leaving us a rating or a comment on your podcast platform of choice. Also, feel free to send us your suggestions for future episodes. This podcast is made possible with the generous financial support of our listeners. You can help us continue producing these kinds of discussions on the topics that you care about by making a donation to Resources for the Future online at rff.org/donate. RFF is an independent, nonprofit research institution in Washington, D.C. Our mission is to improve environmental, energy, and natural resource decisions through impartial economic research and policy engagement. The views expressed on this podcast are solely those of the podcast guests and may differ from those of RFF experts, its officers, or its directors. RFF does not take positions on specific legislative proposals. Resources Radio is produced by Elizabeth Wasson, with music by me, Daniel Raby. Join us next week for another episode.